Patsy. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I'm so happy today to be able to welcome a very special guest to the program. Sharon McCrum is probably one of the top 100 writers in the United States today. And the wonderful thing about her work is that it is the type of books that will last way into the next centuries and beyond. So I'm so happy to welcome Sharon to the program today. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about authors and where they start from. Recently, after reading John Grisham's book, where he talks about, of course, about the papers of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it's more and more I'm thinking about which authors that I speak to and the authors that, you know, people read today, who will be still of such great interest that we would want to go back and look at their papers and look at their research. And certainly your name is right there at the top, because your books are something really special. You're not just a writer, you're also a scholar.
Well, my motto has always been the saying from the French scientist Louis Pasteur: chance favors the prepared mind. The more you know and the more connections you can make, the more substance you can put in your work.
Well, you certainly have substance in your work. All of your books are amazing. And the new book, The Unquiet Grave, which is going to be released on September 12th, is right there at the very top. And I just want to tell all of my listeners that they can pre-order it. It's always wonderful to pre-order for an author. And I know all of your fans are pre-ordering, and I hope all of my listeners will pre-order this book, because it is a wonderful thing to do for an author, first of all, because then, you know, they get noticed when people do pre-orders. But also, for all of the people who love your books, this is just a wonderful time to you know, get their name down there.
It was a fascinating book to research, because it's a true story, but it's always been told as a folk tale, which means that everybody else who ever looked at it just sort of made up details rather than actually finding out what happened. And so I couldn't go and look in books to research The Unquiet Grave. I had to go back to primary sources. I've been telling people I deserve a PhD for this book.
Well, I imagine, just from reading the book, first when I read the book, now, of course, I'm not familiar with the Southern folklore, so it came to me as something new, which is, you know, fascinating in itself. And then as the story unfolds, and I realize, my goodness, there's so much work and research behind this book, and then to read the actual, how you actually did the research and the really volumes of research that you did on this.
Maybe we should tell people what the book's about.
Exactly. Let's tell them, because it is a fascinating story. And it's a story that you've known since your childhood, right? It's a story of a murder in... Will you go ahead and tell the story?
Yes. It really happened. In 1896, a young woman in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, she was about 22 years old and fell in love with the new guy in town, who was a blacksmith and very evasive about his past. And her parents didn't care for him, but try telling her that, because he was a very handsome young man. So they got married after only knowing each other for about 6 weeks. And then little details keep coming out, like she's his third wife, and the last one died mysteriously only a year ago at the age of 21. So he's looking worse and worse. But before anybody can do anything about it, 6 weeks after they get married, riders come up to the farm of her parents to tell them that their daughter Zona has fallen down the stairs and broken her neck, and she's dead. So they bury her in the churchyard, and 6 weeks later, in late February, Zona's mother goes to town to the office of the county prosecuting attorney and says to him, "My daughter was murdered by her husband." And the prosecutor says, "Well, how do you know that, ma'am?" And she says, "Because my daughter's ghost told me so."
And it goes from there. And they believed her.
Well, I'm sure that Mr. Preston, the prosecutor, devoutly wished that she would just go away, but she wasn't leaving. So finally, just to get her out of the office, he said, "Okay, I will have the local doctors exhume the body, and we'll do an autopsy, and that'll be that." So sure enough, they sent three doctors out to dig up the grave in the churchyard, did the autopsy across the road in the little schoolroom, and discovered within 5 minutes that her neck had been broken and that there were fingerprints on the neck. So Mama was right. They took the guy to court, and she got up on the stand and testified that her daughter had told her the details of what happened. So that much is in the folklore. Everybody knew that. What they didn't know was about the attorneys and the fact that Mr. Gardner, the first African-American lawyer to practice in southern West Virginia, second-chaired the defense for this guy. And I found the lawyers just as interesting as the murder case.
Oh, I think it is just wonderfully done. It was so fascinating, the conversation between, of course, the lawyer, Mr. Gardner, and the doctor, because we'll have tell people, of course, he was committed to an insane asylum for, so his conversations with his psychiatrist are fascinating.
And nobody knew that either. I found that in the census records. I was tracking everybody. And when I got to 1930, I found Mr. Gardner in an insane asylum in western West Virginia, and nobody ever knew about that. So then I found out who his doctor was, and that sent me on months and months of research figuring out the details of the doctor's life. The doctor was only 29 years old.
At the time. And he lived well. Time. He lived well into when he passed away, 1979, was it? The doctor.
He was in the asylum in 1930.
Yeah, but his doctor survived and lived for many years afterwards. And yes. Were you able to contact his family?
I found a great niece, the granddaughter of his older brother, and she sent us a picture of him as a child. And we said, "Well, where is he buried?" And she didn't know. She gave us the name of the cemetery, and it turned out to be not him, but his other brother. So I have spent the last 6 months combing Westchester County, New York, which is where he died, trying to find him. And we're beginning to be afraid that he's in a coffee can in somebody's garage, because there's no record of him having a burial.
Right. So you get such detailed research. And how long did this take you to do this research on this book?
The really intensive part, about a year and a half. But I've known about the story for ages, because I only live about 70 miles from where it happened.
Well, it's really nice. You know, nowadays it's so nice. I could go onto Google Maps and I could just, you know, type in. And it was funny to go to, you know, right to the location. I could look right at the road and the countryside, which I don't think has changed that much, except the roads are paved.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing when we're talking about this, these people, these hill people, and you make everything so vivid. And it's hard when you look at the map and you realize how very close they were to major metropolitan areas. But yet life was so different for them. They're in the hills.
They were 90 miles from Washington. In fact, if you've heard of the Greenbrier Resort, where the National Governors Conference happens every year, that was only about 15 miles from where the trial took place.
It's the dichotomy, the difference in life for these country people, and you recreate it so in such detail so that we really feel. Now, let's talk a little bit about the mother, Mary Jane. Mary Jane, I think, is one of the best characters. Well, of all your characters, I mean, I love all your characters. When, you know, I love Harm Sorley, which is the main character in your book, She Walks These Hills. And I always, when I think about a character, when I think about this mountain life, this sort of love actually for the mountain life and the countryside, and I think of Harm Sorley, and I know all of your readers who have read that book are always truly amazed at how you created such a wonderful character. And now with Mary Jane, the mother of Zona, the young woman who was killed, you've done the same thing. You've really brought her to life.
What impressed me, and she was, of course, a real person, what impressed me about her was she lived on a four-acre farm, which is just subsistence living. You cannot really support a family on a four-acre farm in a rural area. So she has no money, no education. She lives 15 miles from town. She has no connections with important people. And yet she has the nerve by herself to walk into a fancy lawyer's office and say, I want justice for my daughter based on this ghost story. And this is a time when women were considered second-class citizens anyway. So what courage that must have taken to face down this well-to-do, educated lawyer and say, you do this for me.
And, of course, now, did you find any of the family, the remaining family?
No, I didn't. I probably will meet them when the book comes out, because the premiere of the book is on the 10th of September in Lewisburg, where it happened, and it's going to be a benefit for the Greenbrier County Historical Society. So I'm sure that if there are descendants around, but of course Zona didn't have any descendants because she died 6 weeks after.
Well, we don't know. Actually, she might. Well, we don't know the name, so that's part of the story.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing is, of course, in having living in this area, there are so many people who are interrelated and who are part of this community.
Well, she had brothers, and uh-huh. So she may have, but I mean, that was 100 years ago, so it's very possible that they are scattered all over the United States.
Now, your family, when did your family come to this area?
When did your
own family? What's your background, your family background?
My family, I'm in the DAR. My family got to Western North Carolina in the late 1700s, and I had an ancestor who fought at the Battle of Kings Mountain, which Thomas Jefferson called the turning point of the American Revolution. So that was one of my many great-grandfathers, and the other one practiced law in New Jersey after having been kidnapped as a child from an island in Scotland. And he fought in the American Revolution up in Morris County, New Jersey, and then after the war, homesteaded in Western North Carolina. So I think Western North Carolina reminded him more of Scotland than New Jersey did. So he was very happy. Yeah. So my ancestors really have been in the southern mountains since the 1700s.
Now, of course, you have taken so many of your books, of course, come directly from events that occurred in this area. Like your ballad series where you take a song and then you've traced it back, or you've used that as a way to tell the story. This is an amazingly rich area for storytelling, that's for sure.
I was interested in the people who slipped through the cracks in history, the people who never kept diaries or had biographies written about them, and maybe they had some important contribution to make, or they had a tragedy in their lives, but they never got to tell their side of it. And so I think of myself as a speaker for the dead. I say to them in my mind, what would you want to tell people? What would you want us to know?
Well, I think you've definitely done that here with Mary Jane Hester. And, of course, as I said, with Harm Sorley, which is a character that I never can get him out of my mind when I'm thinking of the South. And, you know, of course, now you have made, I think, one of the things that you have done over the years since I think your first book came out when, 1995?
Was it? She Walks These Hills?
Yeah. And the thing is, you popularized the Southern story, and definitely when J.D. Vance came along with his story, I think your readers were ready for that.
My readers thought that he wrote Mein Kampf.
Well, it's funny because for people like. I'm from northern Michigan, so I knew nothing about the South until the first time when I read Thomas Wolfe as a teenager. And that was my first encounter with the South, because it's really, for people who have not experienced the South, it is a different world.
I think a very useful thing that I said in She Walks These Hills, if you're reading about a culture you don't know, this is pretty much true. Cities are judged by their richest inhabitants, and rural areas are judged by their poorest. And in both cases, you are getting only half the picture.
Well, it's true. You know, I think I come from northern Michigan, where we have the same rolly countryside. We have the same poverty, but I don't think we have the rich stories that you Southerners have.
We have a lot more than poverty. I mean, please don't think.
Oh,
that,
no.
That...
No, of course you have. You have. I think one of the wonderful things is Dr. Gardner is such an example of what a person can become, and how he has He's a marvelous character. Well, a real person.
Yes, and she was first generation here. Mary Jane's father came from England, which turned out to be really important, as you remember at the end of the book.
Yes, but we don't want to give that away.
Yeah, but he came from Yorkshire, so you'll find that's pretty typical of the settlement patterns. Some of my ancestors, the ones who weren't from Scotland in England, came from the north of England, from Yorkshire. And we tended to bring over a lot of the sayings, the quilt patterns, the fiddle tunes. There's so many things that you find here that if you go back to England, you'll find them there as well.
Now, with...
So, you know about Cecil Sharp?
No.
The early 1900s, a man who was a music scholar, Cecil Sharp, decided that he wanted to make a record of all the old folk songs before they disappeared. Child ballads, for example. And so he went around trying to collect the old songs in England, and he couldn't find anybody that knew them. They were all singing new songs. And he had just about thought these songs had been lost forever when he got a letter from a woman in Western North Carolina who said, you know those songs you're looking for in England? You better come over here because they're still singing them. So Mr. Sharp came over and on a muleback, he went from one community to another all over the mountains in Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, and he got over 1,000 songs and published them as folk songs of the Southern Appalachians. And so if you spent your youth listening to Joan Baez, the Kingston Trio, all those folk singers of the 60s, that's where those songs came from. If he hadn't recorded them and if the people in the mountains hadn't preserved them, they wouldn't have existed.
Well, we owe him a big thanks because I remember all those wonderful Joan Baez songs that we...
Yes.
I wore out records in listening to those songs, didn't we all?
That's what I was listening to in college, and I had a very life-changing experience with that. I learned to play the guitar very badly. I can play 500 songs with 5 chords, you know. So I bought a Joan Baez record when I was at school, and just playing by ear, I learned some of the songs from her album. And then I went home to wow my father with this new skill that his tuition money was making possible, and called him in the living room after Thanksgiving dinner and started playing this song. And my father, who was raised in East Tennessee and who's descended from that Scottish fellow who had been kidnapped, my father joined in on the song. And I was horrified because this was the latest in college music at UNC. And I said to my old father, how do you know this song? This is what the cool people are singing. And he said, well, I had that song from my grandmother, and she had it from her grandmother. So I went back and read the liner notes on my Joan Baez album, and that song was from Yorkshire in the 1700s. And so my father had this song handed down in the family for many generations, and I went to the record bar and paid $6.98 for it, which told me that culture is a really fragile thing, and you need to hand down the songs and the stories and the photographs and everything from your family because it's so easy to lose it. He had never sung that song to me. So if I hadn't happened to find the record album, I would never have known about that song. And it was a family song.
Wow, that's a great story. Well, you have done a marvelous job in preserving all of these stories through your books, and
yes.
And really,
yes.
it is something that, as I said, you know, books come and go, and we always hope that they'll last for centuries. But in your case, I think this is definitely true because the stories that you're telling, the stories that you're bringing out, and luckily, you have the ability now to do the research and still have this connection to people who, you know, who have the diaries or have the notes or have the court records or whatever, so that you can preserve these stories.
I'm seeing the whole culture of the Mountain South as my family, and I'm trying to preserve their family stories so that they won't be lost.
Well, that's important because, you know, as it's like what happens is happening in England in many places now, the accents are disappearing and all of the young people sound exactly alike and they don't sound like their you know parents or their grandparents, and I'm sure that's happening also in the South. Eventually everybody starts sounding like they came off of Sesame Street or something. So it's wonderful that you're preserving these stories and even the dialects that, you know, the words that are part of the South.
I think it's important. I think that, and I think it's something that everybody needs to do, because if you think about it, you, whoever you are the only link between the past and the future. The people that you knew when you were a child are gone now. So if you want your children and grandchildren to remember them, you have to tell the stories.
Absolutely. That's why I mean, one of the reasons I started this program, which I call Joy on Paper, and I say it's a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And I tell people, don't just dream about it, actually start writing. And the, one of the best ways is to start writing the story about your family and preserving these memories.
Yes, exactly. They are so fragile. They can be lost in a generation.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And Sharon McCrum, I want everybody to go to Amazon or wherever books are sold and pre-order the new book, which is going to be coming out on September 12th. It's called The Unquiet Grave. It's a wonderful read. And once they read that, I also want to recommend, I just listened to the Audible version of She Walked These Hills, and I think it is one of the best Audible books I've ever heard.
Oh, good.
Have you listened to it yourself?
I'm very shy about that. I don't think I've ever listened to one of my books.
It probably makes you blush. One writer said, well, I can't listen to it because it makes me blush. But I said,
yes.
In this case, I'm telling you, this is so beautifully done. And the narrator has just captured your words so beautifully that it is something that I would highly recommend that all my listeners go and also get the Audible version of that book.
Oh, well, good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks again for being on the program. And I will just give a special shout out to Irene Goodman. Okay?
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. We're going to just have a commercial, and then we're going to be back with Tana French. Oh boy, she's got a bestseller. We'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Tana French. I am so excited about talking to her because I love her books, and especially her Dublin Murder Squad books. Hi, Tana. Are you there? Am I pronouncing it right?
Hi, Patsy. I'm here.
Do you say
yes, you are.
Tana, not Tana? It's Tana.
Nope. You've got it bang on.
Okay.
You got it right.
Okay. And let me hear you speak. Do you have an Irish accent?
No, I've got a mixed-up accent. I grew up all over the world, and everyone knows I'm not from where they're from, but nobody knows quite where I am from.
Okay. Well, it's got enough of an Irish lilt there. I like it. I love Irish accents. And, of course, you live in Ireland. And So it does rub off. But I love the Irish accent. So I'm always happy to have somebody on who has a nice accent like that. So
even a bit of one.
Let's talk about your new book called The Trespasser. It's the sixth in the Dublin Murder Squad series, right?
Yeah. It's kind of, they're a chain link series they're all set on the Dublin Murder Squad, and the narrator of each was usually a secondary character in a previous book. So you go from detective to detective.
Yes. Now, the new one, of course, is, wow, what a story. Tell us a little bit about the premise of the story.
Well, the narrator is Antoinette Conway, and she's a detective on the murder squad. But she is a good detective, but she's not really getting on that well in the squad. She doesn't play well with others. She's a tough cookie. She's pretty harsh. She's pretty abrasive. She got off on the wrong foot, and she hasn't done anything to try and fix that, because she's the type who does not like going an inch out of her way in order to suit anybody else. And so her working life has basically degenerated into harassment from much of her squad, everything from like humiliating pranks to full-on sabotage. And then she and her partner, Steve, get a case that at first seems like a very routine lover's tiff gone wrong, where, you know, a woman is found dead, young woman is found dead in her house, next to a table set for a romantic dinner for two. So the obvious assumption is boyfriend came over, there was a fight, he hit her, the end. But they start to realize as they investigate that somebody on their squad really, really wants them to arrest the boyfriend, close the case, and move on as fast as possible. And they have to figure out, is this just lazy policing, or is it part of a conspiracy to get rid of Antoinette, to like make her make a huge mistake so she'll be booted off the squad, or is there something deeper and more sinister going on?
Now, as you said, it carries through. You have main characters and sub-characters, and in this book, Antoinette, of course, is the lead character here. But I also like her partner, Stephen Moran, very much.
Yeah, Stephen's shown up before. He was a minor character in Facing the Place and then the narrator in The Secret Place. He's kind of the opposite of Antoinette. He's a nice guy, a genuinely nice person, and a people pleaser to the extent that sometimes he kind of loses hold of himself or his integrity or what he's aiming for in his kind of need to make sure that everybody else has what they're looking for, what they need and want. And he and Antoinette did not get on very well at the beginning of Secret Place when they were thrown in working together. But by this point, they've realized that they actually balance each other very well. But their partnership's still very new, and it's coming under a lot of pressure from the squad and from the case.
Now, the name of the... This is... how do you pronounce the name of the victim, the young girl?
Aisling. It's a very Irish name. It's kind of a standard Irish name. But yeah, I know it doesn't translate well, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I knew basically what it was, but I didn't want to... Okay, let's say it again.
Aisling.
Because it's spelled A-I-S-L-I-N-N, which for people who are not familiar with, well, there are so many Irish names where they sound not at all like what they look like. So,
oh God, no! This is mild for Irish names. You don't even know how we want to know how we spell five, for example. There's H's and D's all over.
Oh, I know it is. It is very, very difficult sometimes to read Irish names. I love the sound, but boy, sometimes reading. But now, Aisling is an interesting character. And her boyfriend, of course, his name is Rory. And, you know, one of the things that was funny, there's a scene where you write about how Aisling, was, mad at, Louisa May Alcott for the ending of Little Women. and I thought, oh, yes, I remember that feeling when I first read the book. And I thought, I like that you really, you know, of course, it's part of making a character real. And so I really enjoyed that part. Now, what about you? What did you like the ending to Little Women yourself?
No, I was outraged when Beth died. I practically was rewriting large chunks of it and in order to make it work better the way I wanted it to work. But, yeah, I think that you borrow little things as a writer. I don't ever borrow kind of major actual characters or actual people or anything like that. But I borrow the odd little thing from real life, like that moment when I was reading Little Women and going, what? You can't do that? Borrow little stuff.
I think all of us, you know, every woman, you know, when we were girls and we were interested in reading and interested in writing and we read Little Women, we all sort of had that same feeling, you know. What did Louise May Alcott do to us here?
Yeah, exactly. Laurie ends up with who?
Exactly.
That's not right.
Yeah.
But I think in a way it's a compliment not only to the book but to the whole process of reading, that it can get you so deeply engaged that you feel like these are real people and you feel like it's all gone horribly wrong in their lives and it needs sorting out, like it matters that much.
Well, that's what you have managed to do, and I assume that you were a good reader when you were a child.
Oh, God, yeah. No, I was one of those total immersion readers where my mom would give me a new book and I would just vanish. I wouldn't be a functional human being for the next few hours until I'd finished it. I just, total immersion reading. I miss that. You know, I miss that now that I'm a grown-up, I've got kids of my own, the real life intervenes. I don't get to do the thing where I get a new book and I'm just gone until it's finished. I miss that.
Well, of course, you're writing a lot. I mean, this one thing, you know... There are a lot of cop books, you know, books about police and the police stations, but very few where actually the first time I'm reading you, and that was what's the name of the book? Oh, my. In the Woods, right? That's the first one. And I'm thinking, well, she must have a background in police procedure and being, you know, in a police squad and in you know, just being... You seem to know the scene so well.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. No, I don't have any police background. What I have is an amazing retired detective who, it's not just that he answers my questions, it's that he tells stories. You know, he'll tell me just stories about days on the police station or things he remembers, things about being a detective. And that answers the questions that I didn't even know I needed to ask. That's the stuff that gives the atmosphere, that gives the feel of it, that gives the energy level or the dynamics. And that's what matters more than even the little procedural questions, at least just as much as the procedural questions. And I've had the occasional email from detectives saying, yep, you got that right. And I take that as one of the biggest compliments I can get because these guys are doing serious stuff, you know what I mean? Like, the stakes are really high for them. We're talking life and death and truth and justice. And if I'm going to write about that, I'd like to do it with honesty and with accuracy. So to hear that it rings true is just, it's wonderful.
Well, it does. As I said, I really, when I read the first book, which, by the way, I have to tell people that they really have to go and read In the Woods. It won, I don't know how many awards, and rightly so. I think it won the Edgar Award, Anthony Award. What else? McCavity. I mean, it won everything, and there's a reason for it because it is exactly it. One feels immersed in the book, and as I said when I first read it, I said, well, you know, quite often police, you know, retired police people write books or detectives write books and quite a few, you know, prosecutors write books. I just recently talked to Linda Fairstein and Robert K. Tannenbaum. They were both prosecutors. And so their books ring true because they were prosecutors.
Yeah.
But in your case, I was surprised to discover that you didn't have a police background.
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment. I guess it might have. I actually come from an acting background, so in a way, although I don't have any police background, it's kind of been my job to plausibly get into the head of people who have completely different experiences from me. So maybe that helped.
Oh yeah, that reminds me. When you mentioned that, I had forgotten. Yes, that you were an actress, or I don't know if you still like, but that not many actresses sort of between gigs sit down and write a best-selling book like you did.
That it kind of happened almost by accident, where I was never one of the lucky ones who have just gig after gig lined up with no gap in between. And I got a few weeks work on an archaeological dig in between two shows and had the idea for In the Woods while I was working on that dig. So it kind of, in a weird way, it did lead in. And the acting is actually a huge help for a writer, because you're used to creating a character and to seeing the world of the story and all the events of the story through that character's eyes and that character's biases and, you know, needs and all their emotional state. So it really helps for writing, especially for writing first person, which is what I do.
And, of course, that book sold over a million copies. I'm sure it's still counting, because, as I said, it's, if anyone who reads your current book, The Trespasser, I am sure that they will be so enthralled with your writing that they will want to go back to the beginning.
Thank you. Of course, the
new book has already been, it was Amazon best book of the year, right? And it's just,
it was one of them.
You're really quite an amazing author now, with an enormous following. It's always wonderful when you sell a million books that a nice percentage of those, a nice percentage of those people continue reading you forever and ever and ever.
Fingers crossed anyway. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yes.
If you don't mess it up.
And I don't think you have, because as I said, in this book, in the new book, you have that same, when we are sort of immersed in your book, and when they're doing the interviews, when the police I think the interviews are that you have in there with the suspects are always so good, and again, so well done.
Thank you. Those are, in some ways, those are fun to write, but in other ways, they're kind of difficult, because they're a little bit limited in that everybody has a really clearly defined objective. The detectives go in there wanting to get some information out of either the suspect or the witness, and the suspect or witness goes in there trying to withhold the information. So it's not like the scene has a lot of room to move off on its own. You know, it has to go towards one specific point. But in some ways, it's really interesting, because it does have things in common with acting, where the detectives, like the actors, they're focused on their objective and on assessing the suspect or whoever they've got in there, and assessing what ways of behaving and what techniques are going to get them closer to that objective. So they're very, very focused, and they're in many ways being like actors and turning themselves into whatever will get that result.
Well, I think that, in, you know, with this book and the story about Detective Antoinette Conway and the Murder Squad, it's a fascinating book, and it's one that I think all of my listeners will certainly enjoy. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, now, in this book, of course, there's a prologue, and I think it's a really interesting prologue.
Yeah, it's a short one. It's only a couple of pages. I don't tend to do big, long prologues. But it's Antoinette talking about her father, who vanished off the scene before she was ever born. And, of course, like any kid in that situation, she would ask her mother about him, who he had been. And her mother would tell her, except that as she got older, she would realize that story after story that her mother came up with was completely made up. And she'd ask her for the real truth, and her mother would give her the real truth. And then a few years later, she'd realize that that one wasn't true either. And gradually, as she got older, she finally stopped asking, because she realized that she didn't want to know. And in a lot of ways, that kind of touches on the heart of the book, which is that we tell ourselves stories about our lives. We come up with narratives about to fit our lives into a narrative shape. And Antoinette is very determined that nobody else is going to set that narrative of her life. And people will try, and people do try, to rewrite the narratives of other lives. And Antoinette is very, very determined that no one, including or especially a father who vanished before she was born, is ever going to do that to her.
Well, I think she's a great character, and I'm hoping we'll see more of her because I think she's fascinating.
She's fun to write, I have to say. It's fun, especially if you're somebody like most of us who does try to take into account other people's needs and wants and feelings. It can be a lot of fun to write somebody who genuinely does not give a damn about any of that, who actively refuses to take into account other people. It can be a fun release.
Well, And for the reader, it's a fun read, and that's the important thing, because when you have a story, you know, as you said, it starts off and you think, oh, this is a simple story, a girl gets killed waiting for her boyfriend, and then we go on for a long and lots of twists and turns, which I love in a book. Because it keeps you turning the pages, too.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
So are you on a big book tour?
No, I'm actually kind of immersed in the last third or so of the next book. But I'm just over here in Dublin doing the normal writer thing.
Okay, well, you know, all of us will be looking forward to the next book. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, when you write a book, and because I've been talking to a lot of people who are writing books, they're in the process, and they like finish their book and they say, okay, I'm done. How much, did you write the book completely and then go back and how does it compare, your first draft to the final version?
Actually, it's weird because I edit a lot as I go, so by the time I finish the book, every single section has been gone over 7, 8, 9 times. So I actually hand in the book maybe only a few weeks after I have a complete first draft, because everything's been edited as I go. So I fill in the final holes in that first draft, leave it for a week or so, go back and give it a good shave and a haircut and a push in the right direction, and then I hand it in. Yeah, I edit as I go because I'm figuring it out as I go. I'm not one of these writers who has a solid outline going in. I don't actually know how it's going to end. So there's a lot of rewriting and polishing and figuring it out. I can't really finish it till I've polished the other stages.
So, for example, do you do a chapter at a time or paragraph? How do you do this editing?
It kind of varies. Like, I'll do maybe half of a scene one day, and then as I'm finishing it, I'm rewriting not only the half that I wrote the day before, but also a previous scene that, oops, that needs to change because what I just figured out about this one, and, oh, well, then I'm going to need to edit to shape how I seed that storyline earlier on. So it's constantly kind of flipping back in on itself and requiring new edits and new changes.
Do you keep the original version? So that you can...
so I can compare.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm one of these people who... I'm constantly scared that anything I delete, I'm going to need it. I'm going to change my mind and go, oh, no, it was better the way I had it. So I have about 4 million versions of every book backed up somewhere.
And you write your book directly on the computer?
No, I tend to write kind of a scene longhand to a certain point and then stick it on the computer, and it goes back and forth. I'm a very messy, disorganized writer.
Well, I was thinking, you know, for so many writers, they in the future, there will be nothing for us to go back and look at what changes they made. Like, we go back to Hemingway's manuscripts or F. Scott Fitzgerald manuscripts, and we can see the development and where they've made changes and how they've edited things, just, you know, and made improvements in their writing. But with the computers, so often there aren't going to be any records left for researchers down the line.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really sad. I love the idea of being able to see the little scribbles that people put in, the little notes to themselves, and the little ideas that never particularly went anywhere, or maybe were really bad ideas, because I think even good writers probably have bad ideas. They just know when to ditch them. And I love the idea of being able to see all that, see that process happening in layers, And I think it's going to be kind of sad when all we have is the perfect finished version with all those little crumples ironed out.
Yeah, I was thinking that, and I was thinking it'll be sad for libraries because they won't have any collections, you know.
Yeah, no archives.
They have all these archives and wonderful collections, so you can go back and see the various, you know, drafts of a famous book and the development of an author's work and his talent, the improvements of as he goes or she goes along. And I think it's sort of sad that in the future we won't have that. But
yeah, you don't get to see what the book might have been.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, I hope you keep your records and at least your handwritten ones and save them for posterity. Because I think you're a fascinating writer.
Anyone can read them.
I think you're a fascinating writer.
Thank you.
And everybody, it's Tana French, and the name of the new book is The Trespasser. It's available wherever books are sold, and Tana has and it's spelled T-A-N-A. French is real easy, Tana French, and she has a lovely website. You can go there and find out more about Tana. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I just wish you, well, I know that it's going to be a bestseller. I don't worry about it because you have avid fans who have been waiting, and now they're going to start as soon as, I think one of the problems with your books is that people don't want to read them too fast because then it's over and they have to wait a while.
In fairness, they are massive long books. I write long. I always feel like I should be apologizing to people's backs for the thing
no,
I
no,
carry around.
No, they're just the right length. We really enjoy them. So thank you again for joining me today. Okay, bye.
Thanks
now.
Thanks so much.
Okay,
bye.
Great. Okay, well, okay. That was, she's from Dublin. That's nice. Okay, I want to thank everyone who has sent in messages on Facebook and also on my webpage, which is radio-joyonpaper.com. I've gotten some really nice recommendations of writers to invite to the program, and I've already sent out a bunch more invitations, and I hope that I will have some of your favorite authors on soon. And meanwhile, I want to remind everyone that, like you heard today, these are two wonderful authors, and the most important thing is that they got their words down on paper, and you can do it too. And if you need any help or suggestions, listen to some of my archives. I have some great interviews with literary agents that will give you an idea of the type of books that they are looking for. So join me in a few days, when it's going to be, another few days, and I will have more information on books that you should read if you want to start writing, because there is a process to it, and I hope that I will be able to help you. Meanwhile, remember to share your joy and say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Bye.